I'm speaking tonight on the subject of my talk is the what I call the immortal idea, a brief history of anarchist philosophy, which is one of my principal areas of research. Sorry, I'll try to project a little bit.
That way, hearing aids.
Okay, I'll try to.
It's up all the way.
All right.
Go for it.
The anarchist, wrote Theodore Roosevelt, and this is a quote from a message of his to the Senate Committee on the Judiciary regarding transmission through the mails of anarchistic publications, 1908. The anarchist, wrote Theodore Roosevelt, is the enemy of humanity, the enemy of all mankind, and his is a deeper degree of criminality than any other. From 1880 to 1920 in the United States, these criminals, and again continuing with Roosevelt this time from his State of the Union address from 1901, these criminals whose perverted instincts lead them to prefer confusion and chaos to the most beneficent form of social order, end quote, were mercilessly vilified by the press, repeatedly beaten and imprisoned by the police, and in several notorious instances, deported and executed by the federal government. In France, an estimated 10,000 of them were butchered when the Paris Commune fell in 1871. In Russia, under the Tsars, thousands were rounded up by the Okhrana and shot like dogs in the streets. Under the Soviets, thousands more were captured by the Cheka and worked to death in Siberian mines. In Spain, untold numbers were routinely incarcerated and massacred without cause, first by Primo de Rivera and later by Generalissimo Franco. Who were these people? What did they do or say or think that merited such brutal treatment? As it turns out, most of these so-called enemies of mankind were members of already oppressed and marginalized groups, immigrants, exiles and refugees, vagrants, beggars and wanderers, artisans, dissidents and freethinkers, women, homosexuals, Jews, and people of color, whose sole crime in many instances was that of criticizing this most beneficent form of social order in both word and deed. They published newspapers and pamphlets, organized unions and cooperatives, initiated strikes, marches, and demonstrations, preached the idea from street corners and soapboxes, in short, struggled mightily against a system which, far from being beneficent, appeared, in their view, fundamentally opposed to the goals of freedom, equality, and peace. In the United States, anarchists and socialists campaigned for and ultimately helped to achieve the 8-hour working day, the abolition of child labor, the enactment of safety regulations in the workplace, the minimum wage, and the right to unionize, among other things. They vigorously condemned America's incursions into Cuba and the Philippines, its attempts to overthrow the Bolsheviks in Russia, and its involvement in the First World War. They protested against racial and ethnic discrimination, championed the rights of women, and promoted tolerance for gay people and other sexual nonconformists long before the women's movement, the civil rights movement, and the gay rights movement. Unfortunately, a relatively small handful, both in the U.S. and abroad, resorted to murder, assassination, and terrorism in pursuit of such ends. Then, as now, the bad apples not only spoiled the bunch, but inevitably received the most attention as well. As a result, the anarchist of popular imagination has long been and continues to be a fanatic, an extremist, a terrorist. Americans, already notorious for our historical amnesia, are unlikely to know or even learn about Emma Goldman, Big Bill Haywood, or Joe Hill. On the rare occasions that we are able to recognize and remember a famous anarchist, it is most likely Leon Czolgosz, the deranged madman who assassinated President William McKinley. Although Zaglash's connections to the anarchist movement were regarded as dubious, even at the time of McKinley's assassination, a suspicion which has since been corroborated by historians, he nonetheless remains the prototypical anarchist. The philosophy of anarchism, in turn, continues to be associated with violence, with terror, with confusion, and chaos. It goes without saying that some people who have been identified, or who have identified themselves as anarchists, were indeed depraved lunatics or malicious hoodlums who gloried in the creation of chaos for the sake of chaos. Although historians recognize that such individuals constituted a small minority within the broader anarchist movement, this has not prevented them from consigning that movement to marginalia and footnotes, if not ignoring it altogether, and continuing to play up and sensationalize its most fanatical elements. Philosophers and political scientists, meanwhile, have paid scant attention to anarchism as a political theory. Within the so-called Anglo-American tradition, the precious few who have studied or attempted to study anarchism have consistently misinterpreted and misunderstood it. From a purely academic vantage, the attempt to accurately understand and correctly interpret philosophical theories is generally considered a worthwhile pursuit, even when the theories in question are viewed as obscure, insignificant, or of little interest to anyone save the pure historian. It is safe to assume that this is how many, if not most, Anglo-American political philosophers regard the study of anarchism. As the anthropologist David Graeber points out, however, anarchist political philosophy, quote, is veritably exploding right now, and anarchist or anarchist-inspired movements are growing everywhere. Traditional anarchist principles, autonomy, voluntary association, self-organization, mutual aid, direct democracy, have gone from the basis for organizing within the globalization movement to playing the same role in radical movements of all kind everywhere, end quote. Why, then, has anarchism continued to be mostly ignored within academia and especially within Anglo-American philosophy? Although there are no easy answers to these questions, one tentative answer concerns the fundamentally conservative nature of Anglo-American philosophy. As the late David Mitrani noted, quote, most political philosophers in the past few generations have what the psychoanalysts might call a state fixation. Liberalism is not just one theory, albeit the dominant one among many theories, but instead has become the de facto framework within which all political theorizing is carried out. In such a context, the idea of abolishing the state, let alone capitalism, is at best hopelessly utopian and at worst patently absurd. Ironically, mainstream Anglo-American philosophy, or what is often referred to as analytical philosophy, is more than a little marginalized within the American Academy itself, having largely cut itself off from other disciplines in the humanities and social sciences. The same is not quite as true of various strands of 19th and 20th century European philosophy. For example, phenomenology, existentialism, hermeneutics, and post-structuralism, which have tended to be more interdisciplinary in orientation, drawing freely upon research in other academic fields as well as literature, visual art, cinema, music, etc. Over the last 40 years, a wide range of scholars, literary theorists, art historians, political scientists, sociologists, anthropologists, etc., have returned the favor, as it were, by drawing upon the insights of European philosophy in their own scholarly endeavors. In consequence, many American academics have implicitly or explicitly inherited the Marxist political orientation that colors much European philosophy. As Graeber notes, although there are thousands of academic Marxists of one sort or another, most of them seem to have only the vaguest idea what anarchism is about, or else dismiss it with the crudest stereotypes. The marginal status of anarchism in the academy is therefore a partial consequence of entrenched liberalism on the one hand, and entrenched Marxism on the other. You have the entrenched liberalism within analytic philosophy, and you have entrenched Marxism everywhere else in the humanities and social sciences. This is an exceedingly odd state of affairs for at least two reasons. First, much of the European theory has become a mainstay of American humanities departments. That has become a mainstay of American humanities departments. It's actually disavowed Marxism to greater or lesser extent. And second, Marxism has ceased to be a powerful or even relevant force within most contemporary radical movements. Regarding the second point, Graeber notes that quote, anarchism has by now largely taken the place in contemporary social movements that Marxism had in the social movements of the 1960s. Even those who did not consider themselves anarchists feel they have to define themselves nowadays in relation to it and draw upon its ideas. As for the first point, even those academics who recognize that traditional Marxism has been surpassed continue to frame their analyses in largely Marxist terms, hence the use of post-Marxism, neo-Trotskyism, and similar descriptors. One of the broad goals of my research is to pull academia out from behind the, or at least my narrow corner of it, out from behind the curve. If it is indeed true that the major radical movements of the day are not just post-Marxist, but anarchist in orientation, and this is scarcely in dispute, then scholars who desire to analyze and understand these movements can no longer afford to overlook anarchism. It is not enough, moreover, to consider anarchism in its current theoretical and practical manifestations. The anarchism of today is part of a tradition that stretches back to the early 19th century and even earlier in the strictest sense. In order to understand contemporary manifestations of anarchism, as in Greece last December, Great Britain and France just last week, or the United States, I submit, in the years if not months to come, one must look to their historical precursors. This requires, in turn, that one situate anarchism in its proper historical and intellectual context. All too often, historians have portrayed anarchism as a minor sect within the larger socialist movement. Socialism, in turn, has been identified as one of the two major political ideologies of the modern era, the other being, of course, liberalism. This would seem to imply that anarchism is just one more component of political modernity, albeit the small and largely insignificant one. However, if we construe modernity as one as more or less coextensive with Enlightenment thought and praxis, that is, as a set of distinctive movements, practices, and institutions underwritten by certain distinctive ideas and modes of thought associated with the Enlightenment, then anarchism is not, in fact, nor has it ever been a component of modernity. On the contrary, anarchism has from the beginning defined itself, more or less, against modernity, not by stealing romantic glances at a pre-modern past, but by looking for something new, something that stands apart from, exists outside of, or altogether moves beyond the modern. To this extent, it is rightfully termed the first postmodern, a term that I really don't like, but I use it anyway. Postmodern philosophical and political movement. It was postmodern long before postmodern, as in the 20th century, postmodern in the 19th century. And I will say more about that later. But to be clear, there is more to anarchism than the European anarchist movement which develops out of the broader socialist movement of the early 19th century. In point of fact, anarchism as such, the anarchism which I refer to as the immortal idea, which I admit is grandiose, but you know, all great philosophical ideas are grandiose. They wouldn't be any fun otherwise. It's arguably as old as humankind itself. The most interesting writing on anarchism to emerge in recent years has come not from philosophers and political theorists, but from anthropologists such as Harold Barclay, Brian Morris, and David Graeber, all of whom have argued quite forcefully that human beings probably lived the first 194,000 years or so of our existence in small, non-coercive, non-hierarchical, decentralized, and fundamentally egalitarian communities. We know that such anarchistic communities existed, among other reasons we know this, because a few of them have managed to survive long enough to be studied. The vast majority, however, were wiped out long ago by state and class-based civilizations, which is, of course, exactly what happened to, most of the First Nations of the United States, or the North American continent would be a better way of putting it. We don't know very much about these ancient anarchistic communities because they did not have written languages. But then again, they didn't need them because oral storytelling was sufficient for transmitting culture from one generation to the next. Contrary to popular belief, the earliest writing was not carried out by poets or sages, but by Sumerian pencil pushers who needed an efficient method for tax collection. Mesopotamian writing systems were, in all instances, born out of religious and bureaucratic necessity that simply did not exist in tribal culture. There was no need for levying and collecting taxes and keeping track of who owed who what and so forth. It just didn't exist. That need did not exist. Okay. Yet, the fundamentally free and egalitarian spirit of that culture continues to exist even within those civilizations that engendered authoritarian states, despotic religions, and rigid class systems underwritten by slavery. It is, after all, the ancient civilizations of the Middle East, Greece, India, China, and so forth that give us philosophy, and it is within ancient philosophy, whether Jewish, Greek, Roman, Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, or Christian, that the immortal idea of anarchism is first explicitly articulated. Simply put, as long as there have been kings and emperors, classes and castes, gods and devils within these societies that have written languages, there have been anarchists, iconoclastic traditions of resistance. There have been anarchists such as Zeno and Diogenes in the ancient Greek tradition, for example. There have been anarchist Taoists like Bao Jin Yang, okay, in the ancient Chinese tradition, so on and so forth. Okay. And this is why, simply put, I refer to anarchism as an immortal idea. Because anarchism exists in a kind of perpetually dialectic relationship with the state, with, you know, with class systems, with totalitarian sort of, you know, authoritarian, be a better way of putting it, authoritarian religious systems and so forth. Okay, so anarchism is as much a pre-modern philosophy as it is a modern philosophy. But as I said above, it's also the first post-modern philosophy, and as far as I'm aware, and I mean this in all sincerity, as far as I'm aware, nobody's ever made such a claim about anarchism. In fact, almost everyone who has attempted to trace the origins of post-modern thinking to the 19th century has invariably associated them with Nietzsche. Okay, if they trace it back that far. And those associations are not entirely inaccurate, because after all, there's no doubt that Nietzsche was a systematic critic of modernity, and he subjected every aspect of modernity, its most theoretical foundations and so forth, to rigorous and devastating critique. Many would also argue that Nietzsche was the most important and influential critic. Nietzsche was certainly among the most important and influential critics of modernity. I don't think he was the first, though. I think that credit belongs to people like Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, who was the first self-identified anarchist, okay, and other key thinkers in early 19th century anarchism, whose critique of modernity is actually remarkably similar to Nietzsche's, even though it developed earlier than Nietzsche's. So the postmodern impulse, which I associate with Nietzsche and the anarchist, appeared alongside and coexisted with the modern, not as an outgrowth or a supplement or a replacement, but as a gadfly or a nagging opposition. Throughout the 19th century and since, it has manifested itself in every thought, whether it's from Nietzsche or it's from Proudhon or whether it's from, you know, Derrida or Foucault or whoever, Sartre, that has not only questioned the foundations of modernity, but has attempted to think otherwise. This is all anarchistic thinking. The problem, of course, is that every practical expression of this thought or attempt to translate it into action has thus far ended in failure. Okay. We still have states and class systems all over the place. Okay. All of the revolutions have failed, simply put. Sometimes this has been owing to, you know, the kind of naked aggression mentioned earlier, sometimes owing to more subtle strategies of appropriation and appeasement. In any case, the postmodern has as yet failed to be anything other than an impulse or an attitude or an an abstraction of some kind. More damningly, it has tended to be understood chiefly, if not solely, as something negative, as a negation of the modern. The unifying feature of everything that has been called postmodern, from art to architecture to philosophy, is opposition to enlightenment, the enlightenment, in both its theoretical and practical expressions. If there's anything positive to be found in postmodernism, we are told, it has typically been ignored or overlooked or dismissed as cynical. The result, not surprisingly, is that the postmodern impulse is frequently viewed as a nihilistic impulse, a will to negate, a will to nothingness. At its best, it's clever and playful. It parodies or plays with the failures of modernity from within modernity, a space that it cannot, and it knows that it cannot escape. At its worst, it's the most solemn pessimism imaginable, one that would suggest that we're always and already sloshing toward another Auschwitz, right? Or that Auschwitz is a locus that we're already in and we can't get out of. We're occupying it forever. Can't get out of it. Nowhere is this problem more evident than what has been called postmodern political philosophy. We're told repeatedly that folks like Derrida and Deleuze and Foucault and Lyotard and all the French guys and gals have done nothing except elevate the Nietzschean critique of modernity to a critical mass or a point of sort of ridiculous no return. We're told that they have not bothered formulating alternatives to modernity because they do not believe any such alternatives exist. That in attempting to think otherwise, they have discovered that there is no otherwise to be thought. In recent years, a number of philosophers have begun to challenge such claims. They've done so, moreover, by looking to what so many of their peers have ignored and continue to ignore. And this is interesting. A lot of people have begun looking to the tradition of anarchism. Their investigations purport to reveal that postmodern political philosophy is not a nihilism at all, but in fact, a kind of anarchism, one which takes certain important cues from older anarchist traditions, but ultimately transforms them into something altogether new. This something new is nothing other than the long-lost positive content of postmodern philosophy, which people said didn't exist. It's there after all, okay? As I've already suggested, anarchism cannot be regarded as a fundamentally modern political philosophy that just happens to contain bits and pieces of postmodernity in it. Unfortunately, this is how these so-called post-anarchists, this is what these guys have been called, that I was just referring to, these post-anarchist writers or scholars, Todd May, Saul Newman, Lewis Call, these names mean nothing to you, but there they are. These are the people who are making this argument, some of the people who are making this argument. This is how they've tended to characterize it. They've said, if we look hard enough, we'll find those same bits and pieces scattered about the writings of French post-structuralists like Gilles Deleuze and Michel Foucault. When we put them together, they end up constituting the moral and political framework of a postmodernism which is an anarchism. Okay. Unlike the old anarchism, which they call classical anarchism, okay, the anarchism of the 19th century and the early 20th century, a term which they almost always use pejoratively, by the way, this new postmodern anarchism or post-structuralist anarchism or post-anarchism, all these terms get bandied about. This new anarchism does not rely on outmoded, philosophically bankrupt conceptions of universal rationality or a human nature or essence or any other of the paradigmatically modern illusions which, you know, French postmodernism has allegedly gotten rid of. Okay. So it's kind of like these guys claim that, you know, we've salvaged that postmodern philosophy is an anarchism, but with all the crap, okay, of 19th century philosophy, you know, that these guys inherited from 19th century philosophy more generally just in virtue of being 19th century people. Okay. So all of the good political stuff without all of the bad 19th century philosophy. Okay. All right. Now, although I welcome the renewed interest in a enthusiasm for anarchist political philosophy, I don't believe that it has achieved much for anarchism or French philosophy. By and large, this is because much of what has been written about the connections between them is riddled with inaccuracies, misinterpretations, and generally shoddy scholarship. So let me turn to now to what I take to be an accurate interpretation of anarchist philosophy. I should begin by noting that the role which philosophy, or what we call theory, as opposed to praxis, has played and continues to play in anarchism is a matter of considerable dispute. Unlike Marxism, which is, as David Graeber likely points out, is the only great social movement that was invented by a PhD, anarchism has never been, and has never aspired to be, a fixed, comprehensive, self-contained, and internally consistent system of ideas, set of doctrines, or body of theory. On the contrary, anarchism from its earliest days has been an evolving set of attitudes and ideas that can apply to a wide range of social, economic, and political theories, practices, movements, and traditions. It's kind of like Judaism in that way. As a result of its theoretical flexibility and open-endedness, or perhaps as a contributing factor to it, or perhaps both, anarchism has historically tended to emphasize revolutionary praxis over analysis of and discourse about revolutionary strategy. This practical emphasis, in turn, explains why Marxist-Leninists have traditionally accused anarchism of being anti-intellectual, unscientific, and or utopia. It also explains why some anarchists regard political theory with impatience and suspicion, if not outright disdain. Like, let's stop talking and go do something has been an attitude among a lot of anarchists going back to the earliest days of anarchism. Why are we talking? Let's go do something. And by the way, that was also Marx, the attitude of the young Marx in the 11th thesis on Feuerbach. The philosophers have merely tried to understand the world. The point is to change it. Okay. And that's, the anarchists have always taken that very literally. Okay. In reality, anarchist philosophy has a long and impressive history. More importantly, it has often played and continues to play an important part in anarchist interventions, for example, in working class and labor movements. It's this latter aspect of anarchist philosophy I'm particularly keen to discuss in my own work. The extent to which it influenced real-world struggles and touched the lives of real flesh-and-blood workers, especially those belonging to the industrial immigrant working classes of late 19th and early 20th century America. Too often the writings which were disseminated to and hungrily consumed by these workers, you know, Jewish immigrants, Italian immigrants, Polish immigrants, Spanish immigrants, and so on and so forth in, you know, the Lower East Side, Chicago, places like Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Detroit, in the late 19th century, early 20th century. You know, these are the people that I'm interested in part historically and as a philosopher, because, you know, these people were reading philosophy. They were reading philosophy. And the stuff that they were reading is often dismissed as propaganda. You know, they were reading anarchist tracts. You know, but the stuff that they were reading was actually philosophy. It was damn good philosophy, too. Okay. Why? Because insofar as these tracts and so forth, insofar as they articulate, define political, economic, and social concepts, subject political, economic, and social institutions to trenchant critique against clear and well-defined normative standards, offer logical justifications for their own positions, and advance positive alternative proposals, why should these writings not be regarded as philosophical texts and analyzed accordingly? Obviously they should. They're not being. Nobody does this. Obviously they should, and the fact that they have been so long ignored by political philosophers, historians, and other scholars has everything to do with academic prejudice and nothing to do with the intellectual and philosophical merit of the writings themselves. Okay. I'll say more about these tracts and their why they were written the way that they were and so forth later. But In scholarly literature, the term classical anarchism is most often used in reference to the pre-1918 European anarchist movement. Once in a while, however, for example, by these post-anarchist guys that are running around in academia right now, classical anarchism seems to be something like a catch-all for the work of three thinkers, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, Mikhail Bakunin, and Peter Kropotkin, whose ideas are allegedly close enough that we are justified in treating them all as a single homogeneous unit. As it turns out, classical anarchism, if this is how we're using the term, then classical anarchism isn't, in this sense, is an academic myth. Proudhon, Bakunin, and Kropotkin, indeed most anyone who could be identified or would have identified herself as an anarchist prior to 1918, disagreed on many, many issues. For example, whether and to what extent the use of violence is justified in revolutionary activity, what the role of labor unions is or should be, how to answer the so-called Jewish question, what to do about women, sexuality, marriage, so on, whether and to what extent to collaborate with other revolutionary and left-wing parties, what the best way to organize is, how and when the revolution will be initiated, how post-revolutionary society will be organized, etc., etc. In fact, anarchists probably disagreed more on balance than they agreed with each other. Yet, somehow, despite these often massive differences of opinion, they mostly, managed to stick together without resorting to internal purges, executions, assassinations, or jailings. Okay, unlike the Bolsheviks, for example, okay, who had a really hard time dealing with internal disagreements, okay, famously or infamously. So how exactly was this possible? As L. Susan Brown writes, quote, anarchist political philosophy is by no means a unified movement. Within the anarchist family, and it really is, the term there is apt, there are mutualists, collectivists, communists, federalists, individualists, socialists, syndicalists, and feminists, end quote. Different anarchisms, plural, may provide different definitions of anarchy, the end state towards which anarchists are striving, okay, the kind of society that anarchists are trying to realize. They may have different definitions of anarchy, different justifications for pursuing it, different strategies for achieving it, different models of social, economic, and political organization under it, and so forth. Notwithstanding such differences, all anarchisms are properly so-called by virtue of endorsing certain distinct ideas and practices. The question, of course, is what such ideas and practices might be. Now, one common misconception, which has been rehearsed repeatedly by the few Anglo-American or analytic philosophers who have bothered to discuss anarchism, and they are very few, defines anarchism solely in terms of opposition to states or governments. Okay. A. John Simmons, a philosopher who I otherwise respect, you know, I respect him a great deal as a philosopher, but he just totally misunderstands anarchism. He says, for example, quote, commitment to one central claim unites all forms, oh boy, here we go, all forms of anarchist political philosophy. All existing states are illegitimate, end quote. From this, it allegedly follows that, quote, the minimal moral content of anarchism is just that the subjects of illegitimate states lack general political obligations. Okay, in other words, people living under the aegis of illegitimate states don't have any obligation to obey the laws. Okay. Now, many liberal philosophers, okay, and by liberal here I mean classical liberal, you know, the John Locke's, the John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau tradition, define political legitimacy in precisely this way. That is, in terms of subject, political subjects having political obligations of various sorts, okay, to their sovereigns. Okay. Interestingly, several of these same philosophers would also deny that citizens have general political obligations. though few would agree that this is a sufficient condition for states to be illegitimate. And obviously, none would self-identify as anarchists. And none of these guys, none of these liberal, there are a lot of liberal philosophers running around in contemporary philosophy who deny that we have general obligations to obey the law, interestingly. You know, that idea has become kind of passé. But none of them self-identify as anarchists, okay? Because that's not a sufficient condition for being an anarchist. A.J. Simmons and this other guy, Robert Paul Wolf, who wrote a very controversial book back in 1970 called In Defense of Anarchism. Not the kind of anarchism I'm talking about, by the way. It's this all states are illegitimate type anarchism. Are among those who do believe that the absence of political obligations implies illegitimacy. Though both concede that there may be other moral or non-moral reasons to obey the laws of illegitimate states. This is precisely what enables Simmons to distinguish between what he calls, you know, he starts doing, you know, his analytic, puts on his analytic philosopher cap and starts making distinctions now. This is what enables him to distinguish between what he calls weak anarchism, which is what he considers himself, and strong anarchism. Okay. Weak anarchism is a position that adduces nothing beyond the aforesaid minimal moral content of anarchism. Okay, the aforesaid minimal moral content. Right. Whereas the latter holds that, quote, a state's illegitimacy further entails a moral obligation or duty to oppose and eliminate the state. Okay, so according to Simmons, if you're a strong anarchist, right, and you're living and you judge that a given state is illegitimate, you thereby incur a duty, a moral duty or obligation to work to overthrow or abolish that state. Okay? Whereas if you're a weak anarchist, okay, the illegitimacy of state entails nothing beyond your not being obliged to obey the laws. Okay? But you may have to end up obeying them anyway because you may have other moral or non-moral reasons beyond having an obligation to obey them. And Simmons thinks we have plenty of those, which is why he's a weak anarchist. Okay.
That's your chairman.
He also distinguishes between what he calls a priori anarchism, which claims that all possible states, okay, by their very nature states, are morally illegitimate. He's not one of those either. And a posteriori anarchism, a position which maintains that all existing states are illegitimate, but denies that it's impossible for there to be a legitimate state. Simmons, by the way, was a professor at the University of Virginia, in Charlottesville, Virginia, is a Lockean, is a follower of John Locke, and he holds to a literal, it's very interesting, Simmons is more of what you might call a libertarian, okay, in that he believes that I just mentioned this in passing because it's interesting. He believes in a literal social contract theory. Okay, so in other words, he thinks that a government, the only way that a government could be legitimate is if all the citizens literally, okay, of a government, literally signed on to were all parties to an actual social contract. Okay, and that's the only way that a government could become legitimate, okay, and that's why he's not a, that's why he calls himself just a posteriori anarchist, because right now all existing states are illegitimate because none of them are sanctioned by an actual social contract, but he thinks that that could happen, right? There's nothing ruling out that possibility, right? There's nothing in the structure of states themselves that precludes the possibility of there being a legitimate one someday. Which is fascinating. And he gets this all from John Locke. He's got a book called On the Edge of Anarchy, right, where he says that, you know, John Locke is just one step away from being an anarchist. And the only reason he's not is because he's got this idea of social contract. Okay. And so he says, you know, John Locke is a minarchist, extreme libertarian. Okay. And the only way that we you know, that we we can, in principle, not be anarchists, okay, of the weak a posterior variety, is if we have an actual social contract. It's a fascinating position. I think it's wrong, but I think it's fascinating nonetheless. Okay. Now, wrong, by the way, but from a historical vantage point, not from a philosophical point. That's it, but right here. This definition of anarchism and all others like it is it's idiosyncratic. I just don't think it should be called anarchism. Why? Because the word anarchy, which comes from the Greek anarchos, does not principally mean without a government or without a state or any of that, but it means something closer to without authority. Anarchism is more than anti-statism, even if government is appropriately the central focus of anarchist critique. It's as the generic social and political idea that expresses negation of all repressive power, anarchism is committed first and foremost to the universal rejection of coercive authority. Okay. Now, that traditionally that has included the state, obviously, but not just the state. Okay. And so when these kind of, these more like sort of a, we've been called anti-statists or libertarians or philosophers take up the mantle of anarchism and call themselves anarchists, there's something kind of historically anachronistic about that. They're not really anarchists in the sense in which that term has been used consistently throughout the 19th and 20th century European anarchist movement, okay? Because they're limiting their critique to just one particular manifestation of coercive authority in the state. These guys have nothing to say, for instance, about capitalism. In fact, they tend to endorse it. Okay, so I'm just saying that maybe they should call themselves something else. Okay, or maybe we shouldn't quibble about names, but I take names very seriously. Okay. To be sure, the various schools of anarchism may disagree among themselves concerning why and how coercive authority ought to be opposed, but they are generally agreed that coercive authority includes all centralized and hierarchical forms of government, for example, monarchy, representative democracy, state socialism, economic class systems, for example, those which are generated under capitalism or Bolshevism or feudalism, autocratic religions, patriarchy, heterosexism, white supremacy, imperialism, and so on and so forth. All anarchisms are properly so-called in virtue of endorsing a common moral position. At the deepest and most fundamental level, anarchism as philosophy is an ethics. At least that's what it has been and continues to be, an ethics. Everything that affirms or denies, champions or condemns must ultimately be understood in ethical or moral terms. This is one of the ways that anarchism has historically distinguished itself, and not just distinguished itself, but been distinguished from scientific Marxism. Okay, but just briefly, I think I return to this at some point. At a certain point, the mature